Good morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the studios of KSFR and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen any time of day or night, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like to introduce Chris Hedges, author of the book American Fascists, The Christian Right and the War on America, published by the Free Press. Welcome to KSFR.
Thank you.
First of all, let's start with the basics. What is fascism? I mean, it's a term that a lot of people use without really thinking or knowing what it means.
Well, and, you know, and it wasn't a term that I used lightly. And I began the book by quoting a short piece written by Umberto Eco in his book of essays called Five Moral Pieces, in which he lists what he thinks are the main components that make up a fascist ideology, what he calls ur-fascism or eternal fascism, and that would include, you know, the war against modernity, the cult of masculinity, that obsession with violence, the complete delegitimization of those who stand outside your group. And I think that when we look closely at what it is the radical Christian right in this country preaches, it has within it the seeds of a religious fascism.
Now, describe the elements of the religious right that you call, or that is called, dominionists.
Yes, that's a very important distinction. Because traditional fundamentalists always called on believers to remove themselves from the contaminants of secular society, to shun political involvement, and traditional evangelicals, people like Billy Graham, always warned their followers about getting too close to political power. He himself came to the defense of Richard Nixon during the Watergate scandal and deeply regretted it. What we see now is a radical and very frightening mutation. It is a movement that has fused Christian iconography and Christian language with the iconography and language of American nationalism. That is a toxic and dangerous mix. It is also new and different. Although we use terms like evangelical and fundamentalist to describe these people, they are, as you pointed out, more properly called dominionists or Christian reconstructionists, those who believe that they can create the Christian state, who have as their goal the attainment of secular power. That is something we have never seen before with all of the religious revivals that have taken place within the country. And I think it's important to realize that within the last two or three decades, this movement, as embodied by people like Pat Robertson or James Dobson or others, have moved from the fringes of American society into the very corridors of power, you know, both within the legislative, executive, and judicial branches of government. We have 45 senators and 186 members of the House of Representatives who receive between an 80 to 100% approval rating from the three most influential Christian right advocacy groups in Washington, including Eagle Forum and Family Resource Council. We've also seen this administration hand over hundreds of millions, some estimates run as high as $2 billion taxpayer dollars to groups like Pat Robertson's Operation Blessing that not only practice discrimination based on belief and sexual orientation, but also are using government funds to proselytize and promote their ideology. And that was, I think, unthinkable, you know, even a couple decades ago.
What is their vision for the country and for the world?
Well, it is totalitarian at its core. I mean, this is a movement that promotes a binary view of the world, a black and white, good and evil, infidel and blessed. And there's nothing in between. There's no ambiguity. There is no legitimate way to be other than their way of being. They believe, and I, you know, in something that is always quite frightening, that not only do they know the will of God, but they have been anointed to carry out the will of God. And they would like to create a state where essentially that we would replicate the kind of despotic little fiefdoms that they have built within their own empires or their mega churches. And that is a male figure, almost always white, who claims to be in direct communication with God, as people like Pat Robertson claims to be, who can tell us what is right and wrong in the eyes of God, and essentially shunts aside those who do not embrace this belief system, denounce them as worthy only of conversion or eradication. They would like to turn over social service agencies as well as education to their institutions, which will use them as a form of indoctrination. They would like to have widespread use of the death penalty. One of the sort of foundational documents for Dominionism is a book called The Institutes of Biblical Law by J. Roussas Rushduni. He lists 18 what he calls moral crimes, all of which would immediately result in the death penalty, including blasphemy and apostasy and witchcraft, adultery, along with murder and, you know, more traditional crimes. So the vision that they have of a state, and it is a vision that is attainable for those who want to go read people like Rushduni or Gary North, is deeply frightening and deeply anti-democratic.
We tend to associate the word fascism with Adolf Hitler, and are there parallels to Hitler's Germany with today's religious right?
There are, but I think we always have to be careful about, you know, drawing too facile an analogy of fascism. You know, when you look at those who've tried to dissect what fascism is, there was a very fine book by a scholar at Columbia, Robert Paxton, called The Anatomy of Fascism. There are vast differences even between Mussolini's fascist state and Hitler's fascist state. Fascism is not going to return to us with swastikas and brown shirts. The ideological inheritors of fascism in this nation have found a way to propel their movement forward by wrapping themselves in the American flag and clutching the Christian cross. Indeed, there's a passage in the end of Paxton's book where he talks about precisely that, you know, it's fascism will come with stars and bars and mass recitations of the Pledge of Allegiance. And I think that for those who look at what are authentically fascist movements, we don't want to get too hung up in the outward manifestations or outward symbols of those movements, but look more profoundly at what it is they promote. There are parallels, first of all, I mean, one of the most interesting is that, of course, the first thing Hitler did when he took power in January of 1933 was launch an assault against homosexuals, banning all homosexual meeting places, and culminating in May with the book burning at the Berlin Institute for Sexual Science. That persecution of homosexuals was not only generally accepted and even lauded by the German public, but embraced by the German churches. And Claudia Kunz wrote a great book called The Nazi Conscience, in which she argues that the raw and most virulent anti-Semitism of the Nazis was pretty unpalatable to most Germans, and so that they built their movement on sort of an appeal to traditional values, returning Germany's moral core, and that by sort of stripping homosexuals of their rights, it became a way to legitimate tactics that would then be turned on people who were also defined as social deviants. And I think we do see a parallel in the assaults against the rights of gays and lesbians by this movement, and I think for the same reason. We certainly see the way that these movements mask themselves in the comforting language of Christianity and patriotism, and I think that in that way hide how radical they are. The alliance between the Christian right and the corporate interests that are rapidly creating the corporate state and fueling the American oligarchy, again, is something that one sees with fascist movements. Paxton argues, I think correctly, that no fascist movement is independent or pure, that fascist movements, unlike communist movements build alliances with traditional conservatives within a society and with industrialists and corporate interests, often an uneasy relationship. And we certainly have seen that those alliances, we see it even within the Bush administration, with people who come out of, you know, the sort of neocon, Leo Straussian wing, Cheney, Pearl, coupled with, you know, the evangelical foot soldiers.
We're talking to Chris Hedges, author of American Fascists, The Christian Right and the War on America, published by the Free Press. You say that these Dominionists make up about 12% of the population. Why does it seem like more?
It's actually less, I think. I think I quoted a poll by Peter Green, who I think it was Peter Green, who tried to determine, you know, in terms of hardcore Dominionists, people who actually understood this vision and wanted to see it implanted, was less than 7%. But of course, what they can appeal, or what they can count on, is their appeal to 80 to 100 million people who define themselves as evangelical Christians. And I think many of these people, you know, if a state like this was imposed upon them, would have no desire to live in it. But of course, they're very clever about using that traditional images and traditional concepts to mask what it is they're in fact setting up. So the movement itself is small, and I think that's always true with radical movements. I mean, Crane Britton's great work, The Anatomy of a Revolution, talks about the sort of generic qualities of revolutionary movements, and he notes precisely that you know, in revolutionary Russia, the Bolsheviks constituted less than 1% of the Russian population, but they're ruthless. They certainly turn on their allies once they achieve power, and they count on the sympathy and probably passivity and complacency of the majority.
Tell us about the phenomenon of the megachurch.
Well, the megachurch is, I think, a response to the destruction of community, which unfortunately has just ravaged the United States. My family comes from a former mill town in Maine. And this is just not an uncommon experience to former manufacturing centers. The mill, of course, left. Comparable jobs never came in to replace it. People are working now, 20, 30 years later, at jobs that pay salaries two-thirds or less from what they once got, you know, working at a steel plant. They don't have benefits. They don't have job security. And that has been coupled with a slashing of state and federal assistance, so that when you go into these former towns, not only in Maine, but in, you know, former manufacturing centers like Ohio, the infrastructure is literally falling apart. The schools are crumbling. The downtowns are boarded up. The streets are potholed. And that physical destruction of community, which is a manifestation of the disenfranchisement of the American working class, brings with it a host of social ills, from domestic violence to broken homes to alcoholism, and that has pushed people into the arms of these demagogues who promise a world of magic and miracles and angels and the fact that Jesus will walk with them. And I think that phenomena is something that is sweeping across the United States with the rise of the American oligarchy. The fact that the top 1% in this nation has amassed more wealth than the bottom 90% combined. There's actually an article about this in today's New York Times. And this vast disparity and inequity is something that has political ramifications. It gives rise to mutant political movements. And that's not a new idea. That's something that the philosophers who studied Greek democracy, like Plutarch or Thucydides, understood, that you can't maintain a democracy when you carry out this kind of an assault on your working and your middle class. And, of course, now anything that can be put on software can be outsourced, is being outsourced to India and other places. So the megachurches have risen in response to this destruction of community, in many ways have replaced community. They certainly occupy not only the spiritual time, but the recreational and often educational time of their members. The problem is that they're authoritarian entities. The men, they're almost universally men, almost universally white men, are people who claim to speak for God, who know what is right and wrong in the eyes of God. There is no questioning. They will tell people what constitutes moral behavior and how to behave. But I think more importantly, those people who do not submit to their authority have no place within those communities. So this movement often speaks about family. But in fact, it's the great destroyer of family. And I would stand in these mega churches and listen to these heartbreaking emotional calls on the part of members for those around them to pray for unsaved family members, because of course they weren't admitted into that community if they didn't submit to the authorities of that community. And yet those within the community, their time was so completely occupied that they severed their ties with their old community. And that's the role of the mega churches. It is to recreate community, but not a democratic community, an authoritarian community. And this gets into the whole power structure that they promote. You know, they speak, figures like James Dobson, about giving power back to the male and having women be subservient and children obedient. Well, this is a power structure that, of course, they claim is ordained by God, and that is replicated within these mega churches, they want to see this power structure replicated within the community and the nation at large. But it is a power structure that bears far more in common with fascist power structures than it does with Christian or democratic power structures.
There's a real irony in what you're saying, because these religions draw on the poor classes, people whose lives have really been screwed up in one way or another, to fill their ranks, and yet they totally reject any economic or political analysis of the reasons for that very poverty.
Yes, that you're right, and that is what's so sad. You know, these are people who have been betrayed by us, you know, but I think we should be clear that they have been betrayed by both parties, the Democratic and the Republican Party, that it was a Democratic administration under President Clinton that brought us NAFTA, that deregulated the FCC, allowing these sort of media monopolies, corporate monopolies, that threw a million people off the welfare rolls. And the problem is that when the Democratic Party in the 1980s realized that corporate interests or the corporate state was as willing to fund them as the Republicans, they took the money and ran. The consequences of that for American workers has been devastating. And the abandonment of the American working class and current assault on the middle class has seen people fall into real states of despair or desperation. And I think it's interesting that the great philosophers on totalitarianism, from Hannah Arendt to Karl Popper, cite this despair as essentially the engine of totalitarian movements. Because when you fall into that kind of despair, then you become ripe for manipulation by demagogues who promise this world of magic, who promise a kind of utopian paradise, whether it's fraternité, égalité, liberté, a worker's paradise, or the second coming of Jesus Christ. And I think that is precisely what's besetting the country. I think a lot of critics of the Christian right naively thought that the 2006 elections marked a kind of watershed in which the movement was declining in importance. I would argue that until those disparities are met, until we begin to recreate community for people who've lost community, until we re-enfranchise tens of millions of people in this country who've been pushed aside back into our society, there will be no way to blunt this movement.
There's an interesting quote that in your book from Dr. James Luther Adams, talking about the four freedoms, freedom of speech and religion and freedom from want and fear. And I think we often think about the freedom of speech and religion and so on, but freedom from fear. I mean, freedom from what? Those are the exact lacks of freedom that the constituencies of these churches have, and that really draws them into the church. They're scared. They don't have enough.
Well, it's a fear-based movement. And, you know, there was a very fine documentary called Jesus Camp that I think, it's the only documentary that I've seen that captured what can only properly be described as child abuse. It is about terrifying followers into the embrace of this system. And sitting through, you know, hours of listening to these preachers spew out this stuff, it had a frightening kind of schizophrenic quality to it where, you know, in one moment they were talking about a loving God, a loving Jesus, and then on the other about, you know, being cast into outer darkness and suffering the torments of hell. And they would do this, you know, often within, as they were speaking, within a minute or two. I mean, you would swing back and forth from these two emotions, and it had the effect of sort of knocking you off balance. It is a fear-based movement. It is a movement that, asks that question as to whether you're right with Jesus, and if you're not, and if your family members are not, what awaits them at the end times is a horrific, horrible and brutal extermination. And that, of course, is brought to us with this obsession with, I mean, pornographic obsession with these depictions, fantastic and completely non-biblical depictions of what will happen when the rapture comes. I mean, the rapture, by the way, the word rapture never appears in the Bible, and the whole eschatology of the rapture is a creation of Darby and other proponents. It's not a biblical, it's not biblically based, but it's effective. And I think, like all despotic movements, they keep their followers in check through fear.
We're talking to Chris Hedges. It's interesting because there's a lot of end time movements going on right now. I mean, here in Santa Fe, a lot of people believe that there's great significance to the end of the Mayan calendar, which is about 5 years from now. And everyone seems to be using words like time is running out. And on the right, they're talking about moral turpitude. On the left, they're talking about global warming and pollution. I mean, is there a relationship between these different strains of end time thinking?
Well, time is running out. I mean, that's real. You know, if we don't make a radical change in the way we live, we are going to commit collective suicide. I mean, I think that's what global warming is, and that's not wrong. Unfortunately, there are two ways to deal with that. One is to alter our lifestyle and begin to live in such a way that we protect the environment around us. The other is to welcome catastrophes and to believe that they are signs on the road to Armageddon. And I think part of the perniciousness of this movement is that it promotes a theology of despair, a theology which says nothing in this world is worth saving, including non-believers, and that the most glorious moment in human history will come at the end of human history when the earth and all those who do not submit to our ideology are destroyed, and we, in this kind of weird spiritual Darwinism, are lifted naked up into heaven. And that is, that's what happens when you embrace a non-reality-based belief system, which these people have. They have out of desperation. So that I think to the extent that we as a society continue to refuse to confront the looming catastrophe in front of us, and the worse things get, then, of course, it will empower a certain segment of the society that prefers to leave the discomforting reality-based world to embrace this non-reality-based world of magic and a promised utopia. So I see, as things deteriorate, this being a kind of feeder into a movement that really propels us closer and closer to collective suicide. Now, you know, raising the point about the obsession with the Mayan calendar is interesting because I think that, I speak as a Presbyterian seminarian, I finished seminary, that, you know, the New Age movement does bear some characteristics that are similar to the Christian rite, and that they also embrace a world of magic. There is a kind of, within the New Age movement, a non-reality-based belief system. Now, they're not organized in the way the Christian rite is. They're not seeking political power, but I think it's fascinating that totalitarian movements, such as, for instance, the Nazis, were obsessed with the occult, that in some ways, although I think that the New Age movement is politically benign, there are similarities, that again, it is a way of retreating from a reality-based world, and unfortunately, the worse the world gets, the more that temptation to retreat becomes enticing and attractive.
I have to say, a lot of people who embrace New Age ideas will say everything happens for a reason. And after 9/11, nobody said that for a couple of months. It was quite refreshing.
Well, I lived through the siege of Sarajevo, so I have very little patience for people who believe that stars or God or anyone else is out there, you know, protecting them and wrapping sort of a cocoon of safety around them and watching out for them. I mean, 4,000 children were killed in Sarajevo during the siege. I just spent too much time in war zones to recognize that we live in a morally neutral universe. But I think that that tendency to ascribe to stars or to Jesus or anyone else, a kind of power that watches out for me, is really at its core a form of narcissism.
Well, I wanted to ask you, how did the research and writing of this book compare to your experiences as a war correspondent?
Oh, it wasn't as emotionally traumatic. Certainly wasn't physically dangerous at all. I think that what was interesting in this book is there was a kind of convergence, you know, as someone who comes out of a church tradition and somebody who went to seminary, but also somebody who had lived in disintegrating states, like the former Yugoslavia. I understand how despotic or totalitarian movements work. I mean, and not in a theoretical way, but in a real way. I watch the Christian right, and there are many similarities I find to Slobodan Milosevic's Serbian nationalist movement. I think I'm keenly aware, because of those two strains of my background, the engine or the as well as the tactics that are embraced by this movement, because I've seen similar movements work, and because I'm biblically literate, I'm very attuned to how they distort and misrepresent the Bible, and frankly make up whole portions of the Bible, to promote an ideology that is really an anathema to the Christian Gospels. I mean, the notion that Jesus came to make us wealthy is ridiculous for anyone who reads the four Gospels. The notion is, as this movement claims, that Jesus was a warrior, you know, or as Jerry Falwell says, a man with muscles, or when they do have depictions of Jesus, he's carrying a sword, is absurd. I mean, I'm not a pacifist, but Jesus clearly was a pacifist. Jesus' obsession was with the poor. There are, of course, hateful and bigoted, morally indefensible passages in the Bible, both in the Christian Bible and the Hebrew Bible. The Gospel of John has repugnant passages of anti-Semitism. Paul defends the institution of slavery, turns against homosexuals. There are whole parts of the Hebrew Bible where God appears to bless genocide and vengeance. But what's disturbing for those of us who find the Bible to be a foundational and an important ethical and moral document, which I think it is that they pick out the most hateful passages within it and ignore the rest. And I think that's a window into what it is they want and what it is they're promoting. I mean, there's a great line by Reinhold Niebuhr. You know, he said, religion is a good thing for good people and a bad thing for bad people. Mm-hmm. And these are bad people.
Well, there's another particular irony, which is that even as the Christian right is very much anti-Darwin, anti-science, and so on, they're really embracing a kind of social and spiritual Darwinism in the form of free market capitalism and, putting themselves at the top of the food chain.
Yeah, very much so. That whole issue of creationism is actually really important. It is really not about presenting an alternative. It is about an assault on dispassionate, honest, intellectual, and scientific inquiry. It is about essentially making facts interchangeable with opinions, making lies true. Once you elevate creationism, which no scientist embraces or accepts as a viable form of the origins of our Earth, you have said to people that you can believe whatever you want to believe. And that is, of course, exactly what totalitarian movements do. You know, facts are discarded when they become inconvenient. And they have removed, 54 million Americans, now according to polling, believe in that the Earth was created in 6 days, according to Genesis. Well, you've removed these people from a world where, from a rational world. And, they've shut the masses off, or their masses off, and thrust them into a very grim, imaginary universe. And, of course, once they achieve power, they will thrust the rest of us by force into the same universe. Creationism is not a benign force. It's a very, very pernicious force. And the fact is, the fact that it's being taught in public schools, that there is a bill in the Texas legislature now to ban all discussion or mention of evolution in Texas school textbooks, gives us a step, or shows us, as this movement progresses, how dangerous they are, and the kind of world that they will force the rest of us to live in.
Let's go back to the metaphors of sex and war that seem to be found everywhere in this movement. You were talking about the images of, buff, muscle-bound Jesus Christ with a sword, and this whole ethos of hypermasculinity and submissive femininity, intolerance of any gender violations like homosexuality and all of that. I mean, what does that give people? I mean, what does it lead to? What's the reason for it?
Well, it gives people a sense that they can control the world around them. It gives people the illusion of order. When you create a binary worldview, when there is no human ambiguity, it also allows people to deny or turn away from the darkness or the lusts or the emotions that exist within them that propel them to carry out acts that they know are wrong or that they wish they did not commit. The problem is that instead of on a moral level, understanding that we all have the capacity for evil and for atrocity, that we carry that within us, that's something that as a war correspondent you come to realize very swiftly. You end with a situation where evil is external. And when evil is external, then it's a matter of silencing or shutting down whole segments of the world around you in order to create a purely good world. That's extremely dangerous. And that drive to create a sort of a new heaven and a new earth is one that, has seen millions of people sacrificed in this vain and fruitless pursuit towards utopia. So the notion of Christ as warrior, the notion of, and of course you're right that they do indeed use constantly the language of war and violence, the notion that the strong strains of aggression that are exhibited both linguistically and in sort of the intolerance preached by this movement are really a way of cultivating within their followers a notion that, there are people on this planet who have no moral legitimacy. And ultimately, in order to create the paradise, they must be eradicated. We see it, for instance, not only in the language they use to talk about gays and lesbians, but in the language they use to talk about Muslims. For those of us who covered conflicts, that's very disturbing because you first get people to speak and think in the language of violence before you get them to act violently. That's something that I saw in the former Yugoslavia, where it took 4 years of sort of hate propaganda pumped over Serbian airwaves before Milosevic got anyone to cross the border into Bosnia and begin his campaign of ethnic cleansing.
I mean, it seems like such textbook psychology. You know, you hate and try to repress that which is within yourself. And then you see these sex scandals with people like Ted Haggard, who is militantly anti-gay and then is found to have a male prostitute.
Right.
Do you think right-wing more ministers are more prone to sex scandals and corruption of that kind than, say, Unitarians?
Yeah, because it goes back to that point of evil being external. I mean, clearly Ted Haggard was struggling with his own homosexuality. And I think that, you know, some of the most virulent homophobia comes from people who are probably trying to grapple with their own attraction to people of the same sex. You know, that's pretty basic psychology. And I think that the... you know, I'm not claiming that everyone in the Christian right is gay by any means, although remember that Jim Baker also had homosexual liaisons, you know, there's that belief that if I can just stomp it out. I mean, for instance, this guy Barres, who's leading the anti-pornography campaign in Ohio, has been arrested on pornography charges. I mean, he is he's admitted sort of pornographic addict, and rather than sort of coping with his own psychological problems, he lashes out at society and at peep shows and everything else in a way of trying to eradicate or create a sort of sanitized or cleansed world around him by which he won't be tempted. And I think that we see the assaults against homosexualities, not in all cases, but in many cases, by people who are not comfortable with their own sexuality.
Well, you make an important point, which I think is relevant to this, namely that these movements often achieve the exact opposite of their intention. Another example of that is young people whose only sex education is abstinence then end up with more teenage pregnancies and sexually transmitted diseases. And, you know, as you write, the states that have more conservative and religiously motivated politics also have higher divorce rates. Do they recognize this?
No. I think that they, you know, oftentimes espouse an ideology that is in direct contradiction to the way that they have lived their own lives. But I think that this ideology plays on their shame and their guilt. You know, I went to a pro-life weekend in Valley Forge, Pennsylvania, and they asked the post-abortive women in the room to stand. Well, the more time I spent among the pro-life movement, the more I found that not only were many of the most ardent activists women who had had abortions, but oftentimes multiple abortions. And this movement preys on that shame and that guilt. There's a group called Rachel's Vineyard, where post-abortive women go for the weekend, and they're given dolls. And they're told that these dolls are the babies they have murdered.
Oh my God.
And they must carry these dolls and clothe them and name them and talk to them for the weekend and sleep with them. And then at the end of the weekend, they offer them up to God and they make a vow or a commitment to go back into the society and fight the culture of death. You know, this is really pernicious and dark stuff, preying on people who are psychologically wounded. And I think that typifies the movement, that they seek out the vulnerable and the wounded, and they're nothing if not astute as to how to exacerbate those wounds and that sense of shame, and use it in a way to keep people in lockstep with them.
Now, when you were doing all this research, were you undercover, so to speak? I mean, did you blend in as a believer?
No, I always used my name. I was always very upfront about who I was. You know, I if people asked me, I told them that I grew up in the church, that my father was a Presbyterian minister, that, you know, he was involved in the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement, and the gay rights movement, that I had graduated from Harvard Divinity School, that I was not born again. And that seemed to work really well because I think partly because it was clear by the time I finished that I knew the Bible pretty well. You know, many of the people, and I didn't spend much time with leaders of the movement. I mean, I did, you know, I did go hear Dobson and these kinds of people, but I spent a lot of time with the followers. And many of them are decent, earnest, well-meaning people who really wanted to reach out to me and bring me the message of salvation. And I think that's what's so heartbreaking about the movement, that these are not bad people. I think that the leaders of the movement are manipulative and dangerous, but many people within the movement are extremely well-meaning. And I found that, you know, I found many of their stories, especially before they found Christ, and the struggles that they went through, financial, emotional, psychological, really heartbreaking. That, you know, it was a huge window into the despair and the desolation that has gripped, you know, tens of millions of people in this country, and really the refusal on the part of our country to acknowledge it or even cover it. I mean, if you look at the media, it's very rare now that we get depictions or stories about the lives of these Americans. I mean, you know, a big paper like the New York Times may go out and do an 8-part series and submit it for a prize, but their voices are almost never heard, and I think that's because advertisers don't care about them, so that there's a kind of catering to the elite, and these people increasingly are voiceless. And that, of course, that builds within them a kind of frustration and only propels them further into the arms of this movement that does give them a voice. Unfortunately, it's a voice filled with rage. It's a voice that says, you know, America was a great country, but the liberals and the immigrants and the homosexuals and the feminists and the, you know, intellectuals came and took it away from us, and we're going to get it back. It's a very primitive kind of response. But the rage that's articulated is real and not without foundation.
Did you see people kind of waking up and leaving these churches?
Well, it's very hard to leave these churches because, you know, in order to enter these churches, you essentially walk out on your old community and become enveloped or embraced by a new community. And if you do leave the new community of these mega churches, if you become what they call a backslider, you become a non-person. You're erased. And for people who don't have a great deal of stability or a particularly well-developed network, you know, going through that kind of an experience is emotionally devastating, so that it very rarely happened. I mean, most people, you know, because of fear and because of, you know, that need to have some kind of sense of structure and meaning in their life, became locked into the system. I did meet people who left, they certainly are the people who understand best what this system is about, but they also suffered a great deal emotionally from having gone through it. I interview some in my book.
I guess they'd have to have something else to go to if they left one of those churches.
Well, most of them didn't. I mean, most of them left because they, you know, they had the kind of intelligence and self-criticism that allowed them finally to see what was going on. But it was a lonely and difficult departure, and one filled with a great deal of pain. And you know, even years later, these people carry pain from what was done to them. I find the power structure and the relationships that are fostered by this movement to be deeply abusive.
Now, these giant mega churches, I mean, they are associated with TV networks. They have a lot of money, millions of followers. And at the same time, they talk as if they were persecuted people. What's going on with that?
Well, that's that cultivation of victimhood, which is essential for movements that would like to lash out at a society around them. And they need that feeling of victimhood. Of course, it's absurd, but it's not absurd if you're within the movement. You know, they have a highly cultivated persecution complex, and they warn believers to be constantly on guard for forces, satanic forces that mask as benign social forces out to destroy them. I mean, that's why people like James Dobson go after the public school system for promoting secular humanist ideology. I mean, the notion that, you know, public school systems are promoting an ideology is absurd, but it's one that's effective. And, you know, the media and everything else in their eyes becomes infused with, you know, dark forces that are trying to subvert American Christianity. And that sort of careful cultivation of paranoia is one that keeps followers locked in the belief system and makes them distrustful of any information that's not handed to them by proper authorities, so that, you know, they can discount rational argument or facts as being tainted and manipulated by demonic forces that seek the creation of the kingdom of Satan and the destruction of American Christians.
We're talking to Chris Hedges, author of American Fascists, The Christian Right and the War on America, published by the Free Press. Do you think that left-wing religious groups see themselves as a part of the good in the grand struggle between good and evil?
Well, I think left-wing, or let's call them liberal religious groups, are largely bankrupt. I think that happened when, with white flight in the urban areas, the churches packed up and left as well. And they moved out to the suburbs, almost universally racially segregated, certainly economically segregated, and continued to preach about compassion and justice and empowerment of people they never met. You know, I felt that when I was a divinity student. I lived in a housing project in Roxbury, and I commuted into Cambridge to go to Harvard. And, you know, everybody at Harvard liked the poor, but they didn't like the smell of the poor. They'd all go down to, this was the time of the Sandinistas, they'd go down and pick coffee for a week and credentialize themselves as revolutionaries, but they'd never get on the Green Line and go over to Roxbury to the projects where I worked and to confront the fact that people within their own city were being warehoused little better than animals. So I think that hypocrisy has pretty much destroyed the liberal church. And, of course, now many of the mainstream denominations, my own, the Presbyterian, but you see it with the current fight within the Anglican Church, are really torn apart by these movements. And the leaders of these churches don't want to take any kind of a stand for fear of angering their constituencies. And so the churches have become, the mainstream churches or the liberal churches, have become largely irrelevant.
You write about how important it is not to be passive. I mean, these right-wing religious organizations have a tremendous political force. They swing elections. Some people within them are actively involved in manipulating elections. But even just on a legitimate level, they get their voters to vote in the conservative direction, in the Republican direction, and so on. But how is one not to be passive in the face of this, given that, as you say, that is not a group of people who want to debate? They're contemptuous of everybody else. There's no dialogue possible. We live in a free speech world, but that dialogue isn't going on. What are people to do to speak up about it?
Well, I think we have to stop giving this movement any religious legitimacy at all. This is a mass movement that seeks the destruction of our open society. And unfortunately, the response of many mainstream Democrats is to reach out to the movement. I mean, there's that famous line by Kerry during the last election in which he said, you know, I also have values. Well, these people don't have values, and by pretending or arguing that they do and that we do too, you're giving legitimacy to people who shouldn't be legitimized, and we're delegitimizing ourselves. I think there has to be a much more aggressive assault. People like Pat Robertson or Jerry Falwell or James Dobson are con artists. There's nothing religious about what they do at all. And I think the the way we tiptoe around the movements and the way we give them a kind of legitimacy within the society is going to come back to haunt us. The same thing happened in the former Yugoslavia, where the democratic forces within Yugoslavia tried to domesticate Slobodan Milosevic, believing that if they brought him into the political system and treated him as just another political player, they could tame him. And they were wrong. And I think that we're seeing the same process here. I think it's extremely important that Americans begin to stand up on behalf of gays and lesbians who are being stripped of their civil rights by this movement. Because, you know, the gays and lesbians in this country have really become the canary in the cage. When they finish with them, they will then turn on the next in the long list of social deviants, whether it's women or immigrants. And I think that the passivity, the complacency, and, of course, liberal institutions, great research universities are all part and parcel of this, is making this movement possible. You know, this is a movement that really has within its sights the destruction of academic freedom, for instance. Yet where are the heads of the universities speaking out forcefully against this, denouncing these people? Well, they don't, because, of course, you know, most universities have become corporatized. They want the money. They're appealing to financial interests that frankly care nothing about a liberal arts education. I worry deeply that we as a society, in the name of tolerance, are tolerating the intolerant. And as Karl Popper notes, when a society tolerates the intolerant, then tolerance disappears and the tolerant along with them.
And you get into a real paradox. I mean, intolerance of intolerance. I mean, I don't know if you saw the South Park episode called Death Camp of Tolerance, but it's, you know, it's tricky business. And a church that has a rhetoric of victimhood can really capitalize that and turn it against everybody else.
Well, and I think they've done that very effectively. But the fact is that when we have within our midst a powerful mass movement that is calling for essentially the silencing of whole segments of American society, should they achieve power to build a Christian state, then tolerating that movement is one that will ultimately spell our own demise. You know, it's important, I think, as a caveat, to remember that this movement cannot come to power unless there is a prolonged period of instability. You know, they need that in order to accrue to themselves the kind of power citizens willingly give up in a moment of crisis. But we could very well enter that, whether that's through another catastrophic terrorist attack, an economic meltdown, huge environmental disaster. I mean, one of the little sort of disturbing signs for me is the rise of this mercenary army in Iraq with groups like Blackwater, now 25,000 strong. These people are, you know, beyond the control of a legitimate authority. The founder of Blackwater, Eric Prince, is a charter member of the Christian Right, huge contributor to the movement. And what happened after Hurricane Katrina? These guys in their black uniforms and wraparound sunglasses and automatic weapons and big SUVs with the tinted windows showed up on the streets of New Orleans. And what's to stop them if, you know, a dirty bomb goes off in New York from having them deployed by this government on the streets of New York? I think then we come very close to the creation of what is really a Praetorian Guard. And that's the kind of final, that politicization of the military. And of course, there's huge effort on the part of this movement to control the chaplaincies. They now have over 50%. Groups like Christian Embassy proselytize within the Pentagon. They had a promotional video that was pulled off their website recently in December after criticism of uniformed generals talking about the need to bring Jesus and the message of the gospel inside the Pentagon to the Joint Chiefs of Staff. You know, this is extremely frightening. And one of the things that was fascinating about visiting these mega churches is that the preachers uniformly condemned and attacked almost every institution within American society, from federal agencies that provide social services to public schools to the media. But the two institutions they never attacked were law enforcement and the military. And in fact, they fell all over themselves to bring in law enforcement officials or military officials to laud them for their patriotism and Christian probity, and they encourage their congregants to join the police and join the military because, of course, they understand that they cannot finally have power unless they have, at best, a sympathetic and compliant military and police. And I think that the rise of mercenary forces like Blackwater, which are closely linked with the Christian right, coupled with the kind of infiltration of the military. I mean, I look at these chaplains really as almost sort of commissars, you know, teaching that, that loyalty is no longer to the democratic state, but to a particular ideology defined as Christian, deeply troubling and deeply frightening should we enter a moment of instability or crisis.
Let's end with the Walter Lippmann quote that you have in your book. There can be no liberty for a community that lacks the means by which to detect lies. What are the means by which we detect lies?
Well, I mean, part of the tragedy of, and again, this has to go back to the Clinton administration, is the deregulation of the media industry, the fact that I think 80% of American newspapers are now owned by about a half a dozen corporations. News, certainly television news, is judged solely on its entertainment value. I mean, I think Alex Huxley was right. It's not Big Brother we have to fear. It's, you know, we're all going to muse ourselves to death, to quote Neil Postman. And I think that's what we're doing. I mean, we, you know, if you look at the latter stages of the Roman Republic, political discourse was replaced by the spectacle, by the arena. And I think that that's what's happening to us as well. And, you know, when you hollow out civic life, when it all becomes spectacle and totalitarian or fascist states are very good, if at nothing else, at putting on spectacle, then, you know, the robbing of civic space. I mean, you know, what is civic space now for a community? It's a shopping mall, and if you've ever tried to hold a protest in a shopping mall or do anything remotely political, you will be escorted out the door by mall security. You know, there's less and less place physically for us to protect our democracy and carry out a civic life that is, of course, the lifeblood of a democracy. So I worry that you know, there is a kind of fusion of corporate interests that, you know, run a state on behalf of amoral corporations who are interested only in profit at the destruction of, you know, the working and middle class and the environment as well, with this non-reality-based belief movement that has embraced despair and with good reason and can no longer cope with a reality-based world. That's a very toxic and dangerous mix.
Is there anything that makes you hopeful when you look at that picture?
No. I think what worries me is that, you know, we had a similar situation in the 1930s when many, many Americans were shunted aside. We had powerful progressive forces through the labor unions and an unfettered press that fought back, that gave us the New Deal, that reincorporated these people in our society. And I don't see in an organized way that those progressive forces are there, so that if we should enter a moment of crisis or instability, certainly there'll be many decent, well-meaning, patriotic Americans who will yearn to fight back, but I don't see that they have the organizational mechanisms by which to do so.
Thank you so much, Chris Hedges, for spending this time with us on KSFR.
It was a pleasure. I love your city.
Oh, thank you. We hope to have you back one of these days.
I'm always happy to go.
We've been talking with Chris Hedges, author of American Fascists, The Christian Right and the War on America, published by the Free Press.